You would turn with me in your New Testaments to Acts chapter 17. We'll begin our lesson there in that context. In Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul has reached Thessalonica in his ministry. And as was his custom, as he goes into Thessalonica, he goes into the synagogue of the Jews and preaches to the Jews first. And he looked into the Old Testament with those Jews for several days and reason with them from the scriptures, verse 2, explaining and demonstrating that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying, "This Jesus whom I preach to you is the Christ." Verse 4 says in Acts 17 that some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of the devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. But we're not surprised by what follows and transpires in this divine record of this trip that the Apostle Paul and Silas had in going to Thessalonica. Because while the Apostle Paul certainly was able to persuade some to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that He is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, and persuade others to believe in Him and follow Him, and that by the gospel's power, the Apostle Paul nor the gospel does not have the power to convince those who have already made up their mind in their own rebellious spirit and stubbornness that these things are so. And as they were set in their ways and were insistent in continuing in their ways, this truth that the Apostle Paul preached did not sit well with them. Consider what we see happening in verse 5. The Jews who were not persuaded, becoming envious, took some of the evil men from the marketplace and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason and sought to bring them out to the people. When they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, "These who have turned the world upside down have come here too. Jason has harbored them, and these are all acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus." And they troubled the crowd and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. So when they had taken security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. We see that, obviously, the Apostle Paul and Silas went and stayed with a man named Jason, a disciple of the Lord. Jason housed them, no doubt, showing them hospitality, giving them a place to stay while they preached the gospel in Thessalonica. And when these unbelieving Jews decided to set the crowd in an uproar, they went to Jason, knowing that he had harbored these men. And when they couldn't find them, they took Jason, to the rulers of the city. I want us to especially note the accusation brought against those who preached the gospel, that is Paul and Silas, and then obviously throwing Jason in as one who had been an aiding and abetting the Apostle Paul and Silas as it pertains to these accusations they brought. Speaking of Paul and Silas, Jason's accusers said, "These who have turned the world upside down have come here too, and Jason has harbored them. And these are all acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus." They are recalling perhaps news they've heard from other places, no doubt that had traveled, of Paul and Silas and the other apostles, no doubt just those who are Christians, who have caused a ruckus in other places. They describe it as having turned the world upside down. And we know the accusation that was levied against Paul and Silas was partially false and partially true. It's very true that trouble followed Paul. Trouble followed the preaching of the gospel. Everywhere the words of Jesus Christ of Nazareth were uttered, especially among the Jews, but even we see among the Gentiles and the pagans, trouble followed. We see trouble there in Acts, the 19th chapter. But notice, at the very beginning of the Apostle Paul's ministry, his first missionary journey in Acts chapter 13 and verse 45, the Jews saw the multitudes and were filled with envy as they were preaching to the Gentiles. And they opposed the things spoken by Paul when before then they had been inclined to believe those things. Notice in verse 50, it says that the Jews stirred up the devout and prominent women and the chief men of the city, raised up persecution against Paul and Barnabas, and expelled them from their region. In chapter 14, we pick up in the gospel message being preached in Iconium by the Apostle Paul. And in verse 2, it says those unbelieving Jews who were in Antioch, those unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Verse 4, and the multitude of the city was divided, part sided with the Jews, and part with the apostles. The 14th chapter continues with the gospel being taken to Lystra. And we see in verses 19 through 20 that the Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there to Lystra, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city, and the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. And then we see in Acts the 16th chapter, after the Jerusalem Council of Acts chapter 15, the second missionary journey of the Apostle Paul began as he answered the Macedonian call of verses 6 through 10, and he went to Philippi, commissioned by the Holy Spirit to preach the gospel. And while he was in Philippi, after he preached to Lydia and those women who were at the riverside worshiping God and praying, he came upon some people who were making a profit off of a woman who was taken by a spirit of divination. And it says, after Paul cast that spirit out, they brought them to the magistrates and said, in verse 20 of Acts 16, "These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city, and they teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans, to receive or observe." And the multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrates tore off their clothes and commanded them to be beaten with rods. When they had laid many stripes on them, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. And so it's no surprise to us when we begin reading in Acts the 17th chapter of the gospel being taken to Thessalonica that there were some who were persuaded, but those who were not persuaded caused an uproar. And they sought to ultimately cause some harm to the Apostle Paul and his traveling companions. And when they could not do that, they sought harm for Jason. We read in the 24th chapter, after the Apostle Paul is taken into custody, and there is a Tertullus who is bringing an accusation against Paul that Paul's reputation preceded him. In verse 5 of Acts 24, Tertullus says that we have found this man, Paul, a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, considering the accusation levied against the apostle in Acts the 17th chapter in verse 6, that he had turned the world upside down, we note specifically what they accused him of in verse 7, that he had taught things that and were acting in ways contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another King Jesus. That was something that in the 16th chapter in Philippi that was levied against him, that he's saying things and preaching things and acting in ways that are in rebellion to the empire of Rome and seem to be a revolution that they're trying to start up. We know those things to be false. And I believe that when he says they turned the world upside down, they mean it as the beginning of Luke's gospel indicates, the world of the Roman Empire, the world of Roman rule. And that's exactly what happened to Jesus. Remember in Luke 23 and verse 2, they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And so they were accusing the Apostle Paul and all those who are Christians ultimately of seeking to be revolutionaries and causing trouble in society, turning the world upside down. We know that is a false accusation. They were guilty of no such thing any more than Jesus was guilty of anything of that nature. In John the 18th chapter, Pilate asked him straight up, "Are you a king?" He said, "Yes, I am, but my kingdom is not of this world. And if it was, my servants would fight for me, but my kingdom is not of this world." That ultimately satisfied Pilate at that time, and he was willing to let Jesus go, and we know the story, the Jews would not let him go. But I want to suggest to you that while this accusation levied against Paul and the other apostles and Silas and any who preached the gospel and the Christians in general was not true, that in a sense it was, because that's exactly the nature of the gospel. It turns the world upside down. It takes things as they are and completely shifts the paradigm of thought. It causes men unrest as their world is altered before their very eyes. Concerning Acts 17:6 and the accusation levied against these men, they turned the world upside down. Hendrickson says, "In a sense, the charge that the missionaries are troubling the whole world is correct. The fact is that the gospel troubles, penetrates, and alters society in every part of the world." Matthew Henry said, "In one sense, it is true that wherever the gospel comes in its power to any place, to any soul, it works such a change there, gives such a wide change to the stream, so directly contrary to what it was, that it may be said to turn the world upside down in that place, in that soul. And likewise, Alexander McLaren said, but again, the charges were true in a far other sense than their bringers meant. For Christianity is revolutionary, and its very aim is to turn the world upside down, since the wrong side is uppermost at present, and Jesus, not Caesar or any king or emperor or czar, is the true Lord and ruler of men. But the revolution which he makes is the revolution of individuals, turning them from darkness to light, for he molds single souls first and societies afterward. What we come to realize throughout the study of the gospel message is that the world, those who are not in the church, those who are not saved, those who are not children of God, they're under the rule of another. They're under the rule of Satan. Satan rules their lives as they submit to Satan's rule. They are under the power of darkness, as Colossians 1 and verse 13 indicates. And that's the whole point of Paul being commissioned to preach the gospel, Acts 26 and verse 18, to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God. And while they're under the rule of Satan and the power of darkness, they're under a lie because he's the father of lies. Everything he speaks from deception, and he tells many lies. And so what the gospel does as truth is it completely shifts their paradigm of thought. That is, the way they view the world, their worldview, where they may view it in this way, which ultimately changes the way they think about every single other thing, and it alters their perception of reality. The gospel shows them the truth and the lie, and when they come into contact with it, the world is turned upside down. And I would suggest to you that this is true whether they accept those things or not. And we see that in Acts 17. Some were persuaded, and those who were persuaded, and they were not acting contrary to the gospel, but what they were submitting to it and changed by it, their world was turned upside down. Jews who believed that Jesus was not the Christ are all of a sudden convinced that he is the Christ, and they would forevermore be changed. They could not live the same. But those who had the gospel preached to them in that same place, who were not persuaded and who grew envious and who grew hateful toward Paul and Silas and levied those false accusations, they were also forever changed just for the worse as they rejected that message. And it's important to know we as Christians are the heralds of that life-altering, world-shifting message. And we ought not to be apologetic for it. We ought not to be timid about it. But we should stick to the gospel and realize its very purpose is to turn the world upside down. I want to consider three ways in which the gospel turns the world upside down this evening. Consider firstly, in regard to the truth. What is truth? That's a question that Pilate asked Jesus in John 18 and verse 37 when he asked, "Are you a king then?" And Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And Pilate said to him in John 18, 38, "What is truth?" When he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him at all." We don't know the context of his question, "What is truth?" in regard to his thoughts and intents. The Lord does. We do not. But what we do understand is that even in that time, there was a skepticism about truth, where one philosopher would say this is truth. Another philosopher would say something that is contradictory to it is truth. And so you can almost see Pilate's skepticism or his confusion about Jesus's statement, "What is truth?" And while we don't know the content of his own heart in the context of his question within his own mind, we certainly know it in regard to people's thoughts about truth today. People ask that question, "What is truth?" in a skeptical manner, but also in a way of seeking to prove a concept of relative truth. And that's really the world we live in today, where truth is not objective in nature. In other words, there's no absolute truth. And you hear phrases like, "My truth, what is your truth?" And "Your truth is your truth, and my truth is my truth." Where two people can be having a conversation and one says this and the other says something completely contrary to it. Not in a matter of simple opinion, but giving data and things which are concrete. They will agree to disagree and accept each other in regard to their own thoughts as equally valid because there is no absolute truth. That is the world we live in today, and the gospel is completely contrary to that thought. I want us to consider, though, some consequences to this idea of relative truth. If truth is relative, there is no absolute truth, then there goes out the window any standard of consistency. So think about morality. And people talk about morality. Morality is not something that is up in the air. Does it exist? Does it not exist? Everyone has some concept of morality. The difference is there are some who claim morality has a standard and others claim that morality is up to the individual, which is why one person can suggest that it's moral to allow women to have a choice to execute their baby or not. And others rightly say that it is incredibly immoral to do so. Relative truth leads to the consequence also of undermining the very facts of human biology. We know all this too well, as most recently in our country, that has been the fad, if you will. That has been the consistent downgrade of our nation in regard to sexual matters, where there are individuals who are obviously, scientifically proven, without a doubt, that they are genetically and biologically male or female, yet they claim to be the opposite. And who are we to say otherwise? We have to accept that. And so gender is even made fluid. And quite obviously, if those very simple facts and foundations and standards can be made fluid by relative concepts of truth, then so it is with religion. There is no thought of right or wrong religion, but they're all equally valid. And even think of this concept of our social interaction with each other. There are people who claim to be so tolerant and they require tolerance, but the only people that they do not tolerate are those who are intolerant. That's a problem coming from relative truth. And that's a problem we're going to have to deal with today, especially as Christians. Webster defines the word truth as the body of real things, events, and facts, the state of being the case. So the very definition of the concept of truth is inherently objective. Someone will say, no, truth is not objective, but it is subjective. And they're going to have to deal with the inconsistent logic of that statement. Because for them to suggest that there is no absolute truth, but truth is only relative, truth is not certain, that truth is whatever we think truth to be, they're going to have to reconcile that with the truth of their statement, which they certainly believe is across the board the case. That is objectively true, they suggest. Well, what they do in suggesting such is that they ultimately appeal to and submit to the idea of absolute truth. We need to understand the world we live in today and their thought about truth so that when we come to them with the gospel, we're by no means shocked to see that their world is turned upside down, and some will accept it and some, like in Thessalonica, will reject it. In John 18:37, Jesus did not simply suggest that the only relationship he had to truth was that he bore witness to it. For a few chapters earlier in John 14 and verse 6, he uttered these powerful words to Philip and the rest of the apostles and to Thomas. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." I want us to notice the objective nature not only of truth, but of his statement, "I am the truth." He didn't say, "I am a truth," as if he was one of many truths. He didn't say that "I am truth," as if he's simply stating his existence, but he said, "I am the truth." What he's doing is he's not only marking the possession and origin of all truth, but he's showing that he himself is the essence of truth, and his statement is directly connected to his nature. In Isaiah 65 and verse 16, God is called the God of truth. Jesus, being God, is rightly said to have uttered those words, "I am the truth." In Titus chapter 1 and verse 2, the apostle Paul writes by inspiration and said that God cannot lie. And likewise in Hebrews 6 and in verse 18, he says it's impossible for God to lie. Why? Because that is contrary to his very nature. He is truth. And people are going to have to accept that or live with the consequences of the rejection of that absolute concept of truth. And I want us to consider that this idea of God being true and being truth, Jesus saying, "I am the truth," enters into every facet of our lives. In Hebrews, the third chapter in verse 4, the Hebrew writer mentions that every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. And so if all things were built and made by God, that God was in the beginning and he said, let there be light. And so everything that we see and know, all physical existence in reality only comes from him and he is the truth. Then he is the only infallible source of information concerning all things. And so ultimately the concept of absolute truth has to find an origin, and that origin is God. And people are going to have to come to terms with that. In Psalm 19, in verse 1, as we read from our sermon this morning, it says that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. Notice what he says in verse 7 of that same psalm, that the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. And he goes on in verse 9, using synonyms or at least different words that are describing the same law. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. And so truth is revealed about God and through God and by God in nature. But furthermore, truth is revealed in his word. He is the source of infallible truth. He is not two things at the same time. He is consistent. He's infallible and he does not contradict himself. We find the basis of absolute truth in the scriptures. And those who do not believe in absolute truth, when we bring the gospel to them, their world is going to be shaken. Things aren't going to be the same as they were before. Whether they would accept it or whether they would reject it, they're going to have to live with it one way or another, with their world turned upside down, that I don't get to just decide what is the case. God is the case. He is eternal, and everything that comes from him, not only in nature, but especially the reality of spiritual existence, is absolute. I'm going to have to live with that. I'm going to have to answer to that. I'm going to have to consider whether to live accordingly to that. They're going to have to determine whether they're going to find furthermore what is the whole truth or whether they'll continue living a lie. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul noted that problem that certainly is seen today, right in front of us. In 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 9, he says that the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. There are some people who will reject this concept of objective truth, just like the Jews rejected the Christ in Acts chapter 17 and throughout the New Testament, because they don't love the truth. They just want to do what they want to do. And for this reason, verse 11, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. This concept, as fundamental as it is of objective truth, is going to and is intended to shift the paradigm of men's thoughts and turn their world upside down. And they're going to have to make a decision on whether to continue to living a lie or submitting to what they know is truth and finding out furthermore, what the truth is. You know, following that same kind of thought, or at least a vein of that thought, the gospel will turn the world upside down in regards to our nature as man. And this is something which a lot of people will ignore regarding our true nature under the facade of a relative truth. But in reality, they just don't want to deal with the consequences of such. We live in a world that propagates and promotes a relative truth, but not only a relative truth, but a naturalistic worldview. Naturalism is defined by the New Oxford American Dictionary as the philosophical belief that everything arises from natural properties and causes, and supernatural or spiritual explanations are excluded or discounted. Used to, it was that idolatry was the ultimate sense of intellectualism. And people who believed in one God instead of multiple gods were looked down on and castigated. But now, what is considered as intellectualism and the higher thought of man is that there is no God. That's completely discounted as foolish, but that we have found our origin and we have ascended through natural properties and causes. And they have a problem with this that they would claim the creationist actually has. They pose that we have a problem of linear digression, which means where do we ultimately come from? We say we came from God, And they'll say, well, where does God come from? And if he came from this, then where did this come from? And there's a linear digression, but you see, that's not anything the Christian or the creationist would ever suggest. God has no beginning. There's where it stops, really, where it starts. That's the origin. God is eternal. They have a linear digression, though, where used to the common thought was it went all the way back to this very small atomic matter, and there was a big bang. Well, where did that matter come from? They got to figure out where that came from, that the matter came from, and so on and so forth. They have the problem of linear digression. There is no logic in this concept of a naturalistic worldview, yet so many believe that lie. The most famous naturalist, I would suggest to you, as we all know, is Charles Darwin, who taught this idea of macroevolution, including humans evolving from apes. But there are consequences to this, just like there are consequences to a concept of relative truth. Because if we believe in the naturalistic worldview, if anyone does that, then human value is of no more than any other animal or vegetation. They would suggest that's completely ridiculous, and some would accept it in its foolishness, but they're going to have to come to terms with that. But then they cry, this is immoral, or this is immoral, especially in the political arena with all of these arguments and discussions, especially we're dealing with now. But morality in the naturalistic worldview is unexplainable. And if someone tries to suggest there is a reality of morality, then it is at the very least undiscernible if we're consistent in our thinking. Who's to say what is moral and who's to say what is immoral? And people wonder why we have all the problems we have in the world today when they suggest that we're no different than the animals that we see in the zoo. We're no different than the monkey swinging from tree to tree. That there's no higher purpose. We're just like the animals which live and walk around and then they return to the dust of the earth. We have no inherent value. We are of no significance in the grand scheme of things according to the naturalistic and evolutionary worldview. We wonder why so many young people commit suicide. We wonder why there are people who have the ability to go into a large and thick crowd and commit mass murder. We wonder why we have race problems. Why racism is certainly pervasive, and it's because there is not the belief in human value in regards to the spiritual nature. I would suggest to you, though, that many of those individuals who believe in evolution and naturalism, who think that we have such a huge problem with racism, don't realize that the main proponent of that in Charles Darwin wrote The Descent of Man, which spoke of this concept of macroevolution and naturalism as a work to show that those of color are lesser than those who are Caucasian. So many people don't even realize that, but the whole concept of naturalism flies in the face of any kind of human value and morality. And when we teach them that we are made in the image of God, as Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26 says, that not only were we created from the dust of the ground, but God breathed into us the nostrils, in our nostrils the breath of life, chapter 2 and verse 7, it's going to completely change their lives. Whether it's for the better as they submit to it or for the worse as they just reject it and act like they never heard it. And Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 7, Solomon said that the dust will return to the earth as it was. But that's not all we are. The spirit will return to God who gave it. They're going to have to come to terms with the reality of the end times. In 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10, the apostle Peter writes that the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Elements there has reference to the fundamental and foundational properties of human or natural existence. Elements, like the periodic table of elements, all physical reality in the universe, he's saying is going to be burned up. People are going to have to come to terms with that. If they believe all we are is the physical reality and the physical matter, what happens when those things are burnt up? Because our physical existence is no different than the animal kingdom. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 19 says, what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to dust. And so if we do indeed have a nature, as the gospel shows us, that will exist beyond the destruction and utter lack of existence, put out of existence of all of these physical elements, then we're going to have to ask that question and consider what we will do with it. Should we be living differently because of that choice or because of that fact? And people are going to have to make that choice. You see, such knowledge of the dual nature of man, that he is not simply of dust and physical elements, but he is a spirit created in the image of God, completely alters our perception of value as we look inwardly and we think about ourselves. Jesus talked about that in regard to discipleship in Mark chapter 8. In verse 36, this is what Jesus said. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Is it worth it? Is what I'm doing worth it? And people, when they hear the gospel, their whole paradigm of thinking, their worldview is going to change because now they know that this isn't all there is. And is this worth it to the neglect of what I know will continue beyond the destruction of the physical elements? And such a knowledge will require investigation by those who have heard it into what is most valuable and what is not valuable. In 1 John chapter 2, we see that comparison being made by the Apostle John when he talked about how those Christians aren't to love the world because then they're not loving the Father. And he speaks of all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and eyes and the pride of life. He noted in verse 17 that one is eternal while one is temporary. And we've got to decide what we're living for because the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. That tells me this, that to the person who has this naturalistic view of the nature of man, they will utterly pass away in all that they are. Not that they won't exist as we all will exist, created in the image of God beyond destruction and judgment, but all they lived for, what defined them, what they did with their lives, it was completely vain. What was it for? You don't have any possession. And that's the very gospel truth in Matthew 6 and verse 19. Jesus encouraged, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. But what about when all of these things are dissolved? Well, we who have laid up treasure in heaven, we're going to have it still. When the elements are melted up, those who had lived only for the physical life, they aren't going to have anything. All they're going to have is an eternity full of regret. And with this knowledge, such will fly in the face of physical preservation. Again, from Mark chapter 8, they're going to have to make a decision that might completely be different from any decision they made before as their perception of self-value is altered. And in Mark chapter 8 and verse 35, Jesus demonstrates the drastic change of such. Whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. And that's why people think we're crazy, because they're upside down ultimately and we're right side up. What we've got to do is change them and turn their world upside down so that they can be right as we are. This is going to change the way we view each other. As Luke chapter 10 indicated, when the man seeking to justify himself asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? And he spoke the parable of the great Samaritan. He concluded that you are to go and do likewise. The man who was his neighbor is the one who showed mercy on that man who is left for dead. And so if we are created in the image of God, it's going to completely and drastically change the way we deal with each other. There goes all our problems. If everyone has this mindset and are doing their best to follow it, and this is going to utterly change the way we live, period, as we come to the reality of our being responsible before the eternal one. In Romans 2 and verse 16, the Apostle Paul said that there will be a day that God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to his gospel. All men are included in this. Hebrews 9:27 says, it's appointed for men to die once, but after this, the judgment. And those who come to this knowledge will certainly be shaken to the core. And their world will be turned upside down, and many are going to react in vitriol and hatred and disdain for the message we preach. But there will be some, a select few, who decide to conform to the way of the Lord. It's our purpose and our responsibility to turn their world upside down and show them they're created in the image of God. And lastly, as it pertains to all of this, is the alteration of men's perception of religion. Following this idea of relative truth, it's seeped into religion, and there is relativism in religion. Many believe that there's not one correct religion. I read a quote from Mother Teresa that said she loves all religions and they all lead to the same place. I believe Gandhi said something of the same sort. And there are many, many, many in the world who believe such. Even many who claim to be Christians who believe that Christ is not the only way to heaven. But then there are some who are still erring, who believe themselves to be Christians and throwing that term Christianity around loosely as the world uses it in denominationalism. And they'll suggest that certainly Christianity is the true religion, but you don't have to believe the same thing. So there's relativism even in this broad concept of the world's view of Christianity. And they'll believe you have to believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through Him. But we can be going various ways and believing different things, even things that are self-contradictory. And all of these differing thoughts, all of these often contradictory things are inherently exclusive in regard to their unique claims. And so people are going to have to grapple with the question, if they are inherently exclusive as they're self-contradictory and unique from one another, how in the world could they be equal? Relativism just doesn't make sense. So the so-called Christian denominations have the same problem. And what we're going to have to show them in turning their world upside down is that there is a pure and undefiled religion. In James chapter 1 and verse 27, James writes by the inspiration of the Spirit that pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. That tells us something logically. If he names a pure and undefiled religion, then there is implicitly an impure and defiled religion. And the two, as they contradict each other, cannot be equally valid, and they cannot be equally helpful to our souls. And I would suggest to you that visiting orphans and widows in the trouble and keeping oneself unspotted from the world are merely two facets of that pure and undefiled religion. We need to be able to identify that pure and undefiled religion so that we can show that relativism in religion is not true and turn everyone's world upside down and give them the knowledge they need to have. Consider back in the context of chapter 25 or chapter 1 and verse 25. He says, he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, and this one will be blessed in what he does. He then in verse 26 speaks of a religion that is useless, and then in verse 27 speaks of a pure and undefiled religion. The pure and undefiled religion is the religion that is directed by that law of liberty, which blesses the doer of it. We notice in the 21st verse that the implanted word is able to save our souls. That has much to do with this pure and undefiled religion. And that implanted word must be heard and not rejected so that the righteousness of God can be produced, verse 20. That has much to do with this pure and undefiled religion. We note otherwise also in verse 18 that God brought us forth by His word of truth. Speaking of the gospel, speaking of the New Testament, that is the pure and undefiled religion. And there are a lot of people in the Christian, quote unquote, world, obviously, again, using that loosely, who would wholeheartedly agree with this. But if they agree with this, hey, you have to realize where it comes from, who's the author of it. He brought us forth by His word of truth, the word of truth. It belongs to Him, and He's the one who implanted it. It's authored by God, as we studied in inspiration not long ago on a Sunday morning. And they need to understand the nature of God. Deuteronomy 6 in verse 4, and the Shema that is often recited, obviously, by the Jewish people. We read, Hear, O Israel, Deuteronomy 6, 4, The Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. If the Lord is one, the Lord does not require one thing and then require something that is contradictory to it. The Lord does not allow one thing and then allow something that is contradictory to it. And the Lord is not pleased with one thing and then pleased with a thing that is contradictory toward it or contradictory to it. Those who believe that the word of truth is the pure and undefiled religion are going to have to find out why there are so many differences. And they're going to have to find what is true. As Jesus said in John 14 and verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to that one Father except through me. We need to understand, and they will need to understand, that there can be two people, two belief systems that differ from one another, but they can't both be true. They may both be wrong, but they cannot both be true. And they will claim relativism in religion without even realizing what they're claiming when they suggest in the very concept and essence of denominationalism that we can teach and believe contrary and contradicting things and both get to heaven. But notice what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 10. When he said, I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. For it has been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, I am of Paul, or I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, or I am of Christ. This is what they're going to have to answer to. Is Christ divided? Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you, or were you baptized in the name of Paul? If an apostle of the Lord, who later on in this very epistle in 1 Corinthians 14 will say that the things I write to you are the commandments of the Lord, if he is saying that we are to speak and believe and have the same mind and the same judgment because Christ is not divided, then who is anybody to say that it doesn't matter what we believe? Any religion which serves any other god than that of the Bible is a false religion. And then any other religion claiming to serve that one God who does not serve Jesus is false. And any religion claiming to serve Jesus who does not do what His Word says in its entirety and teach what the Bible teaches in its entirety is a participant in a false religion. And this being the case places an immense responsibility upon each person to find the correct, that is the true, pure and undefiled religion. But many won't follow that way. As James indicates in James 1 and verse 23, that if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in the mirror, for he observes himself, goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it and is not a forgetful hearer but a doer of the word, this one will be blessed in what he does. Those people who have their world altered, their world turned upside down, and they reject that there is one way to the Father through Jesus, that the Word does not contradict itself, and we have to agree on these things. Who reject that are going to be the people of verse 26. As they don't bridle their own tongue, but speak out against the truth of God, their religion is useless. Preaching the gospel is a rewarding thing, and we need to realize that. That's why in Acts the 8th chapter in verse 4, as Paul made havoc of the church and he was dragging off men and women to prison, that those who were scattered went about the world preaching the gospel. They did not allow persecution to cause them to cower under such pressure and hold the truth to themselves and not give it to others. But we also need to understand that it's not going to be easy and it's not always going to be fun, because what we're doing, we're in the business of turning people's worlds upside down. But we need to rest in this fact, as Paul mentioned when he was called mad by Festus in Acts 26 and verse 25. I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak the words of truth and reason. We turn their world upside down. That's their view of it. But really what we're doing and what we can have confidence in is that we're turning their world right side up. And that's exactly what God calls us to. If you're here this evening and have not obeyed the gospel of Christ, we want to turn your world upside down this evening. If you have not obeyed the gospel of Christ, you don't have hope. It doesn't matter what you believed before. It doesn't matter what you convinced yourself in thinking. You don't have hope without obeying the gospel of our Lord. But we can assist you in doing so this evening, and you can have hope. If you have obeyed the gospel, but you've fallen short in some sense or fashion, perhaps you just need encouragement. If we can assist you in any spiritual way, come forward while we stand and sing the song that was selected.